Okay.
Andrew Tridgell, talking on clustering TDB. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks very much. Right, hello everyone. Usually what I do with conferences like this is I think up a topic sort of the 6 months in advance, we need to put in a paper, and usually I choose a topic that I haven't started yet. And so the idea is that gives me an incentive to get the work done before the talk. Now that's worked extremely well over the years. This year it was cut very, very close. So at the end there is a demo of a very, very primitive version of the code I'm going to talk about in this talk, and it started working just late last night. So, it's a near thing, very, very near thing. So please excuse the lack of refinement and lack of pretty pictures in the talk. I was desperately debugging the code over the past day or two. Okay, so clustering. You know the basic idea of clustering, I'm sure. The particular types of clustering I'm talking about is of the order of 10 to 100 to a couple of hundred nodes, each of them with their own local storage, each of them with their own local memory. I'm not talking NUMA-type systems. I'm talking a cluster, a loosely connected cluster of machines, what we used to call at a computer science department at ANU, intimate area networking. That means you've got quite fast network adapters between the nodes of the order of gigabit or InfiniBand or some other low latency fast network between the nodes, but they are independent compute nodes. Now, people use these things to run Samba. And that's a very strange thing, but they do. And I do technical support for Samba in IBM, and the majority of requests that I've got have been related to running Samba on clustered file systems on a cluster, which is really quite interesting. It either means that the code, the current clustering code for Samba is really, really bad and needs a lot of technical support, which is true. It also means there are some customers out there who want this. So, shared file systems. I'm assuming that we already have a clustered file system of some sort in the nodes of the cluster. Either GPFS or GFS or Lustre or CXFS or whatever, right? So I'm assuming you've got some sort of coherent clustered file system between the nodes. But what we wanted to do was serve up that clustered file system from all of the nodes running Samba, running the SIFS protocol to each of those nodes. Now, this talk is about TDB and a clustered database. The link between that and Samba should become apparent fairly soon. I should also mention right at the start that in my talks, I prefer people to heckle and ask questions during the talk. Don't keep all your questions to the end. I don't mind if this talk gets derailed and goes on some totally different topic. If you've got an interesting question, just shout it out, ask it, whatever. Okay. Yes, trolling will not be accepted. Okay. So I'm going to assume also that what we want is scaling. The point of using a cluster is that when you add more nodes, it gets faster. Now, sometimes it is possible with some types of algorithms that you actually get superlinear scaling where you add an extra node and you get more than one on n extra performance, but it's rare and we don't really expect that. But we do want each time you add a node, the performance to get better. And that generally doesn't happen in clusters for Samba at the moment running, trying to serve up the SIFS protocol. It is very, very common that as you add more nodes, it gets slower. Now, that's not good. And so one of the aims we wanted to do is actually get it to go faster. The second point, and one that is often ignored in scalability arguments in clusters, is that you want to start off getting a performance improvement from using clustering at all. So two nodes using a cluster has to be faster than the best single node algorithm, the best single node implementation without any clustering. What you often see in scalability graphs is showing how the cluster code gets faster with more nodes. What they don't show is that you need 15 nodes to get back to the performance if you just had the one node and ran bulk standard Samba. That's what tends to happen, unfortunately. And so we're going for the slightly higher aim of actually getting a performance improvement when we go to that second node, and then continual performance improvement past that up to some reasonable limit. And the limits we're aiming for are of the order of 100, 200 nodes, that sort of size. Okay, protocol coherence. Now, some of you would have been coming from the NFS talk just recently, and where Dave was talking about making NFS suck a bit faster. Well, one of the interesting things about NFS is that NFS version 2 and version 3 can make certain assumptions that a SIFS SMB server can't make. In particular, a NFS server often assumes that if it's got a bit of metadata, a bit of data about a file, and if the data was fresh X many milliseconds ago, let's still assume it's fresh now. Now, that's not always a valid assumption, but it is a way of making things go faster, right? In SIFS, we typically don't have that luxury. We have to actually be coherent. We have to serve up stuff so that the behavior of the cluster is exactly the same as the behavior of a single node, but faster. And that's much more difficult. The reason we need that is that the clients, the ecosystem of our clients, have grown up expecting this behavior, expecting very, very precise, coherent behavior out of this protocol. And when you start serving up, making these sort of shortcuts, what you find is some applications fail. And so we want the baseline clustering to be coherent, to properly serve up this protocol without making shortcuts, without having shortcuts at all. Okay, so what is the current architecture of Samba? People who've run Samba on their boxes see all these SMBD demons. In Samba 3, the way it works is there is a separate daemon per client that is connected. And this is where things get interesting as far as clustering is concerned. Each daemon, each of those SMBD daemons, is connected to a number of databases. So people think of Samba as a file server, but the developers of Samba sometimes think of Samba as a database server. Because internally, a lot of our state, our metadata, is in fact a database-like API. Now, we didn't realize this for a long time. Early versions of Samba, we weren't thinking that it was really like a database, so what we were effectively doing is inventing a database-like abstraction without realizing it in each little subsystem of Samba. So the open file handling, there was a flat text file somewhere that held what files were open. The printer system, there was a little flat text file. We were inventing all these little systems, and we realized what we were really doing was inventing little database APIs inside our code. So we eventually unified that, and we created a very lightweight database called TDB, the trivial database. And that has subsequently made its way into a number of other programs, not just Samba, and it's been quite successful. So, for example, if you run the Linux PPP daemon, underneath it actually uses TDB for its data store. So there's little programs like that that use TDB. Okay, so... I'm sorry? Right, there's a MySQL engine with a TDB backend. Great. So, okay, this should be easy to cluster. If each daemon serves a client separately, and if all the shared state is in these databases, then it should be really, really easy just to make those databases to talk to a normal cluster database, MySQL, whatever, any other, DB2, whatever database you like, and you're all done. You'd think that would give you scalability, etc. But the problem is that requirement that I talked about earlier, where a cluster should be faster than a single node. And what you find is that it isn't, because databases are very, very slow. Now, when I talk about slow, I need to make it relative to something else. TDB, typically on a laptop or a small server, you might be getting 500,000 operations a second, right? Now, typical SQL databases, even very lightweight databases, don't get anywhere near that sort of transaction rate, nowhere near. The same thing happens with file systems. Remember I said I assumed that you would have a cluster file system underneath. Now, from one point of view, a cluster file system is a type of database. It's just a database with a particularly strange API, right, where it deals with data in files rather than records, right? But you can think of it as a database, and you can use a file system as a database if you're careful. So for a long time, what we aimed for in Samba was to stick TDB on the shared clustered file system to assume that the file system would correctly provide all of the byte range locking semantics, etc., that TDB used on a local file system, and to therefore end up with clustered Samba. The problem is that it did really, really badly. The performance was extremely bad. And it wasn't until quite recently that we started to understand exactly why it did so badly. Now, I'll go back for a second a bit and just talk about the various databases in Samba, because you may be thinking, Samba's a file server, what's it got to do with the database? So I'll just describe the basic databases. There's about 20 databases in a typical Samba install. So if I flick across here to a shell, and if I look at a Samba 3 install, then you've got this locks directory, and you look at all the TDB files, they're the databases that are sitting around inside a typical Samba 3 install. All these databases, and you can guess what they do. There's the WinBind ID cache, there's gen cache, locking, messaging, netlogon cache, etc. All of these little tiny databases, right? Now, the ones that really matter for performance are a core three of them. The byte range locking database, which deals with all the byte range locking semantics in the SIFS protocol. The open files database, which records who has what files open with what parameters. And the messaging database, which deals with all of the extra little semantics that require communication between these daemons. They're the three really core pieces that are required to be very fast in order to make clustered Samba go fast. Okay, so the current TDB, how does that work? It's a key value database, i.e. it barely really deserves the name database. So it basically, a key is a binary blob, and associated with that key is a piece of data. Also just a binary blob. So it doesn't have any smarts beyond that. Each record has a single key, and you basically give a key and it gives you back a piece of data, or you can give a key and a piece of data to store it to the database. And that's basically it. There's a few other operations it's got, but they're the core operations. But it is very, very fast. It uses shared memory, typically, mmap. So those operations actually are just memory operations in a typical configuration. It uses FCNTL byte range locking in its default configuration for coherence between the different processes. And it often achieves 100,000 to 500,000 or more operations per second of that order. Okay, so this slide is a particularly important one because this is the nub of how we finally realized why waiting for clustered file systems to get fast enough for us wasn't going to happen, and why we finally realized that waiting for clustered databases to get fast enough for us wasn't going to happen. So for many years, we just said, well, we've got a database abstraction. Once databases catch up with the speed that we've managed to do, we'll all be fine. Or we can stick TDB, our own database, on a shared file system, and it works. Once those shared file systems get fast enough, we'll all be okay. And so we wrote various little micro benchmarks and gave them out to file system vendors, clustered file system vendors, and said, make that go fast. Come back and talk to us when that's fast, then Samba will be fast, right? That technique has worked really well for us in the past for other aspects of Samba. That's sort of where dbench comes from. You know, once dbench is fast, Samba file serving on one node tends to be fast. But this was never going to work for clustered databases and clustered file systems. And the reason is robustness. A file system and a database tries to be robust. If you have a clustered database and one of those nodes dies, one of the nodes in the database dies, what semantics do you expect of the data in the database? Anyone? It should be consistent. You shouldn't lose any data. If you've written that data, it could be somebody's employee record, it could be, you know, some health record or whatever. If that data's been written, then you want to guarantee that when a node goes down, that you don't lose the data. The same with a clustered file system. If you've got a clustered file system of, say, 100 nodes, and somebody's been writing data via one of the nodes, and a node goes down, any of the nodes goes down, if all but one of the nodes, you've got 100 nodes and 99 of them go down, what semantics do you expect from that last node? You expect it to be slower, but it should give back the correct data. And people have been striving for this in clustered file systems and databases for many, many years, putting all this effort into robustness. The problem is that that is completely contrary to what we want in Samba. Because it turns out that in Samba, there is certain data we can lose. And unless the database or the file system understands what data we can lose, it cannot achieve the sort of performance that we need. Because to achieve that robustness that databases want is very, very expensive. If you think about it, you write some data to a node, and you want to survive the complete outage of every node bus plus, except for one, that means that either that data has to be replicated on every node, or the data must be written to shared stable storage. They're your only two options. If you think about the hardware and the layout of a cluster, they are the only two options. Both of those options are very, very slow. If you go any other option, if you say you get all the data on every node except for one, what if that is the only node that stays up? You've lost that data. But in the case of Samba, we can lose some data. Now, which data can we lose? Well, imagine that all of this audience are nodes in a cluster, and there is a client talking to one user, right? One node of the cluster, one server in the cluster. And that node goes down. The way the SIFS protocol works is it's up to the client to reattach to the server and reestablish its state. It's client reestablishment of the state of this protocol. So, any of the state in the cluster associated with that client, we can lose. Now, if we can arrange it so that when you lose a node, the only data you cannot recover is data associated with that node, then we're okay. And in fact, we can arrange that with the data in Samba. We can arrange it so that the only data lost is the data associated with the node that went down. Now, in fact, it's even better than that, because when a node goes down, you actually, in the cluster, want to, for example, lose all the locks and the open files associated with the clients connected to that node. That is the correct semantics to lose that data. So if you can construct your database so that when it loses a node, it loses the data associated with those clients, you don't even have to go through the bother of closing them. It just happens as a result of the database. So that's the basic idea of CTDB. Now, how do we achieve it? Okay. This talks about losing data safely and data recovery. The one part here that I didn't cover when I was just ranting on there for a second is about data recovery. We don't want to have to store all the data at all the nodes, but each node, when a node goes down in a cluster, all the remaining nodes know about the metadata of their open files, their current resources, locks, open files, etc. So they can, you don't have to just keep the data associated with a particular client on that node's server, as long as you can detect that a node has gone down and redistribute the data afterwards. That's one of the key parts with data recovery. I know I didn't explain that very well, and my apologies. Okay, so next aspect of trying to make this thing fast and why it's currently slow, why currently clusters, even without the robustness aspects of it, why they're slow. Imagine that this audience, the entire audience, is the nodes in a cluster. You can see why I didn't have time to do all the diagrams, so I'm using the audience as the diagram. Okay, so this entire audience are nodes in a cluster, right? Now, if I, as a client, want to do an operation on a particular piece of data, I go and talk to one of these nodes. Now, if that node, if the data that it needs, the open file table, information about the locks that it needs to complete that operation is on another node, then the first node needs to talk to that second node. The usual pattern in clustered computing is as follows. The first node gets a lock on the data, then it fetches the data, it might combine those into one operation. Then it modifies the data, then it writes it, then it releases the lock. Now there's a problem with this, in that inherent in that pattern of operations is that one node holds a lock on another node during a network operation. Now, in clusters, network operations can be very slow. They usually, in a fast network, you might be able to get an average of, say, 5 microseconds. But just occasionally something happens, and it takes milliseconds or even seconds to complete an operation. Somebody gets paged out, somebody gets busy, whatever. What you don't want to do is that when one node gets busy, that causes another node to have to wait, which in turn causes another node to have to wait, and that cascades around the cluster. That cascading effect with locking is the core thing that makes clusters not scale. That's why they don't scale usually. That's why you have that limit. So what we wanted was a design where we don't ever hold a lock when we are doing a network operation. Right? So how do you achieve that? How do you achieve a database-like API where you can do a complex operation remotely without ever holding a lock? And the answer is to push the code that needs to be run to do the operation onto the node that has the data. So there's a couple of ways of looking at this from more traditional aspects. One is server-side procedures or stored procedures in databases, right, where you stick a stored procedure in like an SQL database so the code is running on the server node. Another way of looking at it is it's a bit like an RPC system. It's a remote procedure call-like system. Neither of those is a perfect match for what we're doing in CTDB. But basically, when CTDB starts up, a node in the CTDB database registers a set of functions which can be run, and then a remote node can run those functions without a lock held. Not, the lock is not held remotely, so that at no point is a lock held by any node while that node is waiting for a network packet. And that's the key to getting rid of the scalability problem that has been plaguing us in trying to make clustered Samba. Okay. So, the API, what does it actually look like? Now, the API is not the same as TDB. Having these new semantics while keeping the same API just wasn't possible because the old API involved getting a lock, do an operation, release a lock. And that implied that you would have a lock across a network operation. So we've got a new API, and this is a very much simplified version of the API. But basically, you grab a context for the CTDB, set which transport you're going to use. There's two transports we've currently got. One of them is working, one of them isn't. The working one is TCP. The InfiniBand one, well, InfiniBand one might be working. We don't know. We don't have the hardware yet. So we've written an InfiniBand backend as well, but we don't yet have the hardware to test it. But given that untested code is broken code, almost certainly it doesn't work. But we'll see when we first get the hardware. So you have this thing called CTDB set call. And what that does is that provides a function pointer into the database which remote nodes can call. So the idea is that rather than having basic database operations like fetch and store, instead, each module in the code provides the functions that the database can call to the database, which can then be accessed remotely. So the remote node ships any data that's needed across to the node that is holding the record. It gets executed there, and the result gets shipped back, and at no point is there a lock held. So that's what the CTDB call does. It calls to a remote node a function that has been set up earlier in the database. Yep. Right. The particular databases we're dealing with in Samba, an operation like opening a file, taking a SMB byte range lock, etc., only ever has to deal with one record in one database to do the operation. Now, that isn't true of all databases. This is not a general purpose database. Yep. So there's just one record. So what happens is when you provide this function down to the database, you're saying that a function like open file is made available to the database. The code to implement open file for the SMB protocol is very complex. But its inputs and its outputs are relatively easy to characterize in that it deals with a single record that deals with all opens on that file, plus the parameters of the open call, and it then gives back a set of data, which is the success or failure, plus any additional parameters like size of file, etc. So we're pushing that function to a remote node. Okay? So that's the basic API. Now, I've simplified this a little bit. This is the synchronous version of the API. In fact, underneath, there is an asynchronous version of the API. So it's completely event-driven, asynchronous model. But I'm simplifying a little bit for this slide. Okay, so what's the architecture like? What's the architecture for the database? Each node uses a local TDB. So TDB provides the underlying storage on each node. But rather than that TDB being on some shared storage, each TDB is in fact on local storage, or in the usual case, just in memory of we use a flag to TDB called TDB internal, which says to implement the TDB API on top of malloc, right? Which means it is just a transient database that goes away if your node goes down. Now, that's because remember that we were aiming to be able to lose a node and keep going. So if that's the case, we should be able to lose a process and keep going so we can keep all the data in memory. Now, that means that local TDB is very, very fast because there's no disk I/O at all. And it also doesn't need to do any locking, which is also makes it faster. So this is where we start getting scalability, where two nodes can actually be faster than one node, partly because the work required by each node in two nodes is less than the work required by a single node. Okay? Now, next thing is the concepts of L-master and D-master. Every record in the database, remember I said that a TDB is a key value pair database. So there's a key, which is a binary blob, and there's a value, which is a binary blob. Each of these binary blobs has to sit somewhere in the cluster. Every binary blob only sits at one place in the cluster. Only one place. Now, that immediately means we'd have no data redundancy, right, which is where we're starting to get some speed up compared to normal databases, which have to have massive data redundancy. We have no data redundancy whatsoever. Okay? But there are, they have to then believe me that losing that data is okay. So this data is in one place. Now, somebody has to know where that data is. That's called the location master. The location master for a piece of data is the node that knows where that data for the record is stored, which might be on the location master or could be on another node. Right? Now, we get the location master by just hashing the key for the record. So the location master is a fixed function of the key for the record. It never moves. always in one known spot, so anyone wanting to know where the location master is can do a computation, no data lookup, and can immediately find the location master. The location master says where the D master is, the data master. The data master is the place where the particular lump of data for a record is stored. Okay, now why do we separate the concept of location master and data master? Well, it's very, very common in cluster systems to have a lot of locality of reference. You find that a particular client will tend to hit the same sets of files over and again. Once they open a file, they'll tend to do lots of operations on that file. So shifting the data associated with that open file to the node that is most actively dealing with that file is a smart thing to do. So that's what it does. The heuristic we use is that if a particular node accesses a particular lump of data more than n times in a row without anyone else accessing it in between, the data moves to that node. And at the moment, I've set that value as 7 for no particularly good reason. It's going to be a tunable value. So after 7 accesses to the same data, it moves locally, and it then sits on the local node. So backends behind this, we currently have 2 backends, TCP and InfiniBand, and it's async and event-driven. Okay, yep. Yeah, it is a bit like DLM, but DLM, okay, if you look at something like the DLM in Linux or a standard DLM, they still have the concept of having a lock while a network operation is happening. The find, yeah, that's right. The L-master, D-master stuff is not dissimilar to, for example, the Stanford Dash architecture. It's not dissimilar to what SGI use. It's not dissimilar. This isn't a new invention, right? Nowhere near a new invention, right? The combination, the L-master, D-master idea combined with lockless database, lockless cluster database, I haven't seen before, but it may not be new, heaven knows. Maybe somebody else has come up with the same thing before. But that combination is what is a little bit unusual in this system. The individual components, lockless architectures have been around for a while, and L-master, D-master type architectures have been around for donkey's years. Yep. Okay, location master dies. That's fine. A recovery phase, during the recovery phase, we don't mind if recovery takes a few milliseconds or, you know, a large fraction of a second. Okay. So, the location master, every node has a virtual node number, right, which is it's a virtual node number. It's not, it's a real node number, it's a node index into the cluster. Now, during the recovery phase, we have to reassign all the virtual node numbers, right, to a new set of virtual node numbers, and we have to take all of the data we've got, and the virtual node number is the second part of the hash, the number of virtual nodes, second part of the hash in calculating the location master. So all the records then have to move, right, to new nodes. Now, and so the existing data master, after recovery phase, data master equals L master initially, but the node that died is now out of the equation, and any of the data that was on another node has now moved to one of the nodes still alive. Now, if there's only one node still alive, it's all moved to the one node. Yep? Okay. So it doesn't matter if the location master dies. There's no single point of failure in it. Because every node will be a location master for some records, because it's just a hash, so you can't have a location master being critical to it, otherwise the whole system would fall over. Yep? Okay. So as far as processes, how this is going, this is a little diagram that shows how the processes fit together. So imagine you have each of the SMBD daemons. This is 2 nodes, right? Each of the SMBD daemons on one of the nodes goes via a local transport. We're going to be using Unix domain sockets, talking to a little dispatcher daemon. The dispatcher daemon talks via the cluster-wide transport, either TCP or InfiniBand, to the other dispatcher daemons, who then talk up to the SMBDs on each of those nodes, each on the other node. So that's the basic architecture of how stuff flows in the Unix-y way of looking at things. Okay, so record migration. So I've mentioned already that the location master is fixed, the data master moves, we currently trigger moves of a data master after n consecutive requests by the same node causes that data master to move to that node. Okay, so the protocol itself, it's like a database-oriented RPC protocol, and the two most important calls and frequent calls are request call and reply call, which is a packet that sends the set of data.
Yep, Andrew?
It's not in a standard RPC layout. We didn't use, for example, MSRPC or the XDR or any of these standard style of RPC systems. The reason is we want absolutely minimal overhead. We're aiming for systems like InfiniBand, which can achieve latencies of a couple of microseconds between nodes. Now, at a couple of microseconds between nodes, the encoding and decoding layer in an RPC system becomes more expensive. Now, I'm aiming only for homogeneous clusters. In other words, the clusters are all running this. Every node in the cluster is running the same CPU architecture. So the simplest way of doing RPC in that case is that you just send structures, binary structures around. And that makes it extremely simple, very, very thin layer. You're just reading and writing structures to the wire. Yep? That's right. If you actually upgrade the version of Samba, so you're changing the shape of data structures, you have to shut down the entire cluster and start again. Yep? Now, I have a system that for not doing that in my chess server, but that's a different talk. At the moment, it assumes that you're running the same binary Samba on all the nodes. You have to do that. Yep? Currently, none whatsoever, which is appropriate for the types of environments that I've mostly been involved with, but it may be necessary in some environments to add security to this. The only, at the moment, no. At the moment, we haven't built in any security whatsoever, and so anyone could send one of these operations. Now, the simplest way of doing security on top of this is that every packet has a secret key inside of it or a hash of a secret key, and you have some way of distributing the secret key to every node. There are some ways of doing simple security. If you want really good security, use a VPN, but you're unlikely to be using a VPN in these sort of intimate area network clusters. This tends to be a machine room with its own subnet, all of the nodes on their own network, and not talking. Your Windows clients are sitting on an entirely different network in different rooms of the building, so the security can be provided at the network level with firewalls, routers, etc., rather than providing it inherently in this software. Yep, so no security whatsoever at this level. Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yes, yes. Encryption costs an awful lot. It's very, very slow. Particularly as encryption usually implies multiple round trips for a packet, or in many different protocols, it implies multiple round trips. And round trips are absolutely killers in these sort of protocols. Okay, so I'm going to give you a demo. I know that was a very cursory explanation of this protocol, but what I've got is a cluster start, a little script which starts up a cluster of two nodes, right? And so what I'm going to do is start up two nodes, and you can tell that this is just how primitive this code is when it actually launches each within its own little X term, and usually under Valgrind or GDB, each node, right? And so what I'll do is I've now got two completely independent Samba daemons, and what I've done here is I've just bound each to a separate network interface. So each of them is, one is on 127.0.0.1, one's on 127.0.0.2, which is not a real cluster, but I don't have a real cluster here. I was thinking of using OLPC virtual images under VMware or something like that, or QEMU, but didn't get around to it, and I was still debugging this code last night. Now, what the test I'm going to run is, I said we're aiming for exactly the same behavior as you would get with a single node cluster. So my target comparison server is this Windows 2003 box running in VMware. That's one node. It's a single node. And what I'm going to be doing is randomized operations where this test called lock test, which does randomized byte range locking operations against the two connections both on the one Windows server and one connection on each node of my cluster. Right? And then it's going to do completely random operations and see if it can survive 1,000 random byte range locks. Now, the reason I choose byte range locks is that so far I have only CTDBified, if I can coin a new word, converted to use CTDB only that database in Samba. Now, that is the most performance critical database in Samba, so it was the most important one to get done. And it got working to some extent, at least last night, and hope it works today. So what I'm going to do is run lock test. Now, lock test, as I said, takes two server parameters, but it also takes this additional parameter, UNC list, which allows you, for the first server, to specify multiple nodes. So what this is going to do is make two connections to the Windows server, one connection to each of our clustered nodes, and start doing randomized byte range locking. And I've turned on show all operations so that you'll actually see some activity. Now, I might as well also start a network sniffer. Again, you can tell very early debug code when the developer always wants to have a sniffer running, just in case it crashes and then you have something to actually debug. Okay, so I've got our network sniffer, run this lock test, and what it's doing here, you can see one of the servers, the debugging code in the server, where it's allocating CTDB requests, doing operations on each of those nodes, etc., firing the little database requests between the nodes. And here what we've done is we've got through our 1,000 operations, and it has done the same operations against the Windows, the two connections to the Windows server as it did to the two nodes of this cluster. And after 1,000 operations, there were no differences in the behavior of the single node Windows server versus the two node cluster. Okay, so performance-wise, heavens knows yet. The architecture should be very fast, but at the moment, with all this debugging code in there, it would be extremely slow, just all the printfs to print all this out. But beyond this, now we've got the basic system working, is to start running it on larger clusters, real clusters, and see what the performance is like. So we have a working, clustered, lockless database. Any questions? Yep. Right. Samba, yes, I can run it in multi-process mode. Samba 4 can run in either single-process mode or multi-process mode. Now, for debugging it, it's much easier to run each node of the cluster as a single process, because Samba 4 is a great big state machine, and it can handle multiple connections to itself within a single process, unlike Samba 3, which can only have one connection, one daemon. And that makes it much, much easier to debug the system, because when you attach a debugger to one of those nodes, you can put a breakpoint in and you will get all of the places where that breakpoint happens, rather than it being spread across 6 or 8 or 12 different processes. No, the architecture, when I showed this before, the architecture doesn't require this. The reason I am running in a single user mode is it's easier for me to debug. And as I still had bugs as of a few hours ago, I probably still have bugs now, I was running it in that way. But if I have a look at that little diagram, where's the diagram? There it is, that little diagram there. Then this is a Samba 3-like architecture, and Samba 4, the default mode of operation of Samba 4 is also like this. Right? It's just that Samba 4 has got an option on the command line to run all within the one process, which is particularly good for development. But the architecture is that there's a separate dispatcher daemon, and that each of the SMBDs on each of the nodes sends their requests via the dispatcher daemon. Now, if you're running Samba 4 in single process mode, it dispenses with the dispatcher daemon and goes straight to the transport without having to do the extra hop through the dispatcher daemon, which saves you a large fraction of a microsecond. Yep.
Yep. How do you know
split brain? Split brain. Okay. Split brain is where you've got a cluster and the cluster splits in two. Right. Well, there is no single master as long as the underlying file system is still connected. The clustered file system is connected. You're okay. But if, however, the underlying clustered file system starts getting split, you're screwed. And so we just say that's not our responsibility. That's the responsibility of the clustered file system maker to ensure that they cope with split brain using whatever mechanisms they've got, which is basically pretty bad and don't really cope with it very well. But it's not our responsibility. We're constrained to work within the constraints of what the clustered file system can provide to us. Right. Right, that's true. The if we've got different bugs, then we're screwed. Right. At the moment our transports are completely independent. One of the things that we've been discussing in the little development team is talking to the clustered file system and asking its opinion of what the nodes are and how many nodes there are and what their addresses are, and ensuring that stays in sync and getting notified by the clustered file system, right? That allows us to try to cope with the situation where we think there's 12 nodes and the cluster thinks there's 10. Sure, yep. Okay, any others? Yep. Yep. Yes, if any node goes down, the way we detect a node going down, we don't try and detect it as soon as it happens. We detect it at the point where you try to send a message to a node and you don't get a reply. At that point, the node that failed to send the message triggers a recovery, right? Now, the reason for that is we do want to be able to reboot individual nodes in an otherwise idle cluster and be okay. We want to be able to pull out a network card or a network cable, put it back in, or restart a single SMBD. And as long as the system isn't very active, then as long as nobody actually tries to send a message to that node while it's down, it actually recovers. It doesn't need to do anything. Okay, that's the idea. That it does do that at the moment. It automatically re-establishes the TCP connections between the nodes if they go down at the transport layer inside CTTP, independent of the messaging above that. Now, so does that make sense? Sort of answer your question, or sort of? Okay.
Okay, Andrew. We're going to have to leave it there. Let these folk get to their lunch. But I'd like everyone to thank Andrew for his excellent speech. And once again, we have just a small token of appreciation to supply for you, which will come over. And hopefully they can be put to good use at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks very much.
There you go.
I don't need two, I don't think.
Okay,
I don't actually drink beer.
Lunch is now available. It's lunchtime until 2 p.m. when we'll reconvene in here.
I'll give it to Andrew Butler.
And I hope everyone's back here after lunch. Year, so. Thank you.
Hey, Andrew. There you go. Grab a speaker's cup.
It's not fair. You get to avoid all the tricky problems.
That's right. Exactly. Well, it's all the tricky problems that make it slow. And so I should take this off and turn it off, shouldn't I?